Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Tuesday, May 19th, 2020. There is a fundamental rule for people who sell dangerous drugs. If you want to be successful, don't use the product. And it applies to heroin dealers, meth, fentanyl these days. If you want to stay out of the crosshairs of the police and you want to make a living dealing dangerous drugs, you don't get involved in using them yourself. And so for months now, Donald Trump has, like a snake oil salesman, been promoting the use of hydroxychloroquine. He said, "What do you got to lose?" to people who were hospitalized. And he's touted it as kind of a medical miracle. And the studies show that its effectiveness against COVID-19 is highly debatable. It has been used as kind of a last resort, and some people have survived. But there is no clinical study that shows that it is directly effective against this novel coronavirus. But Trump, of course, doesn't need to listen to experts because he talks to people. And people tell him it's pretty good. And so yesterday, while Trump was allowing reporters in the room, he was meeting, I believe, with more corporate executives. And he shocked the assembled fake news experts by telling them that he has been taking hydroxychloroquine for over a week now. He said he's taking it to prevent an infection if he is exposed to COVID-19. So this did shock a lot of people. Anthony Fauci has not been heard from, but he has said in very delicate terms in the presence of the orange monster that he doesn't recommend it because it's not proven effective and it has serious side effects. And Fox News is probably the last place that Trump thought he would get any pushback, because people like Laura Ingraham and Sean Hannity and that little mother, Tucker Carlson, they're all supportive. They're cheerleaders for Trump's amateur pharmacology. But Neil Cavuto showed a little independence and some spine. Quote, "That was stunning. The president of the United States just to acknowledge that he's taking hydroxychloroquine, a drug that was meant really to treat malaria and lupus. The president is insistent that it has enormous benefits for patients either trying to prevent or who already have COVID-19. The fact of the matter is, when the president said, 'What have you got to lose?' a number of studies, those are certainly vulnerable in the population, have one thing to lose: their lives." That's a verbatim, and Neil left out a few words, including a verb there. But Trump had said, when asked why he's taking it, "Because I think it's good. I've heard a lot of good stories. And if it's not good, I'll tell you right, you know, I'm not going to get hurt by it." So two studies have emerged casting doubt on the drug's efficacy. William Schaffner, advisor to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, told CNN the nail has virtually been put in the coffin of HCQ. And one of the studies showed that patients who took the combination of hydroxychloroquine and azithromycin were more likely to suffer cardiac arrest during the study period. So I don't really know the stories of these Fox News anchors. But as it turns out, Neil Cavuto probably knows a lot more than Trump. He advised his viewers, if you are in a risky population here and you're taking this as a preventative treatment to ward off the virus, or in a worst-case scenario, you're dealing with the virus and you're in this vulnerable population, it will kill you. I cannot stress enough, this will kill you. So again, whatever benefits the president says this has, and certainly it has had for those suffering from malaria, dealing with lupus, this is a leap that should not be taken casually by those watching at home or assuming, well, the president of the United States says it's okay. Even the FDA was very cautious about this, unless in a clinical trial, safely and deliberately watched. I only make this not to make a political point here, but a life and death point. Be very, very careful. So I want to thank one of the writers at The Intercept. Oh, no, this is actually coming from Eric Wemple, who writes about media at The Washington Post. We have a separate story from Intercept in a second here. Anyway, Cavuto is in the vanguard when it comes to disease and drugs. It comes from personal experience. He beat Hodgkin's lymphoma when he was in his 20s. In his 30s, he was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. He had open-heart surgery in 2016. He told NPR in 2018, I have a progressive disease. I am not naive about it. It can compromise your voice. The nerve endings that feed your esophagus on up will close. I can't worry about it. I mean, I'll know when I know. Now, this does not make him an expert. It makes him experienced. And I think that his caution is well taken. And Wemple here says that Tucker Carlson roared, watching people in the media talk down a potentially life-saving medicine because a politician they don't like has endorsed it is probably the most shameful thing. I, as someone who has done this for 20 years, talking about hosting TV shows, I've ever seen. It is making a lot of us ashamed to work in the same profession as those people. Another host, Ainsley Earhart on Foxy Friends, called it a miracle drug. Sean Hannity ripped the media mob for waging an unhinged, nonstop, never-ending PR campaign against him. They acted like the president and his hope and optimism about the drug were some sort of mortal sin. So, this repeated treatment of Trump, who acts in bizarre ways like the suggestion that injecting a disinfectant should be tried, and then people who criticize him for these pretty dangerous public moves and statements are just out to get him? So he's a hero and a victim all at the same time in the eyes of his sycophants. We have been alerted that Mike Pence, so far, is not taking hydroxychloroquine. The other story that covers this well is Robert Mackey at The Intercept. And he describes the alarm and confusion over there on the Fox channel. People not sure which way to go. Loyal to the death to a president who makes crackpot statements and decisions. And, you know, I defend Trump's right to take this drug. The White House physician was asked for a statement and delivered one that didn't say that he'd actually prescribed it. It just kind of acknowledged that he's taking it and blah, blah, blah. And the Mackey piece here has a little more tongue in the cheek. And he says, less than 30 minutes after the president made the remarks that prompted Cavuto's alarm, regular service was resumed on the pro-Trump network when the pundit Greg Gutfeld appeared and downplayed concerns about the potentially fatal side effects of the drug. If it's available to you and you can take it, you do it. Now, that's thoughtful advice. So this is this constant meme. I promise not to quote Don Jr.'s tweet, and I guess Eric tweeted, and I can't keep them separate. I don't try. But they keep suggesting that the pandemic, which is not limited to our borders, is not related to our political election season, is a dastardly plot by the Democrats to bring down Trump because impeachment didn't work and Russiagate didn't work and trying to force him to deal with reality doesn't work. And, of course, we have the guy who went public last week, Dr. Rick Bright, sent a testimony and then a 60 Minutes interview, saying that he was forced, ordered, to issue a directive to make the drug available in the pipeline. And because he was so alarmed, he tried to limit distribution only to hospitals. And it is fair to say that people with lupus and with some other conditions do find relief from this medication. But for Trump to be experimenting and brag about it in public is just part of a pattern that is really dangerous. I think that's the best way I can put it. So I don't know what to make of this story, but I will put it in the folder called Profiteering Alert. The Trump administration has awarded a $354 million contract to a Virginia startup that will manufacture a variety of generic drugs and their ingredients, including medicines used to treat COVID-19, at advanced manufacturing facilities in the United States. It's called Flow Corporation, spelled P-H-L-O-W. And they're going to lead a private sector team that will use a continuous chemical process rather than step-by-step approach of traditional pharmaceutical manufacturing. So, this gives us great confidence. A startup company using what appears to be a new process, maybe it's been used before, and they're going to be given this contract. And I'm just waiting to see, you know, which relative of Steve Mnuchin, which brother of Jared Kushner is a founder, a board member, an investor in Flow. We'll keep an eye on that one. With the unusual spelling, it'll make it a little bit easier. Now, I mentioned Steve Mnuchin on purpose because he appeared to be the shepherd who accompanied the sometimes rogue Fed chairman, that's Jerome H. Powell of the Federal Reserve, and they paired up for testimony at the Senate Banking Committee today. Mnuchin was there to cheerlead restarting the economy, going back to work, ending the stay-at-home orders, because he cites a risk of permanent damage if we continue to have a slack economy. And I believe that this was there in the polite language of the New York Times. Powell and Mnuchin offered contrasting views. Well, as I mentioned yesterday, I'm surprised that Powell still has a job, as he was there on 60 Minutes Sunday night. Of course, he never mentioned Trump, but he talked about the long-term damage to the economy if we don't get the health equation figured out before we try to restart the economy. And, you know, Powell is a political appointee. Trump has been as disappointed with him as he was with Jeff Sessions, always tweeting instructions to the nominally independent chair of the Fed on lowering interest rates. But Powell made a lot of great points on 60 Minutes the other night, which are different, if not at odds, with the cheerleading, the blue sky promoted by the Trump administration. And he warns there's clear evidence that when you have a situation where people are unemployed for long periods of time, that can permanently weigh on their careers. But he also said that something like 13%, here it is, I think something like 13% of the workforce is in state and local government. And when revenue goes down sharply, it can mean job cuts and services. And that is a veiled way of saying that the Republicans who are stalling any kind of action or even response to the House-passed so-called HEROES Act that it cleared the House late on Friday last week, that's what he's saying. And, you know, we've got Mitch McConnell and Trump saying, well, these are just bailouts for blue states. Well, I live in a blue state that had a $22 million surplus, and we have a $22 billion surplus, and we have a $19 billion rainy day fund. Yet we are facing a $54 billion deficit next year and probably continuing deficits the year after. Tax revenues are going to be lower. There's no doubt about it. And so the idea that it rewards bad management by Democrats, which may be the case in Illinois, you know, I spent time in Chicago and Democrats have ruled that for a long time. There was a Republican governor in there before Pritzker. But you could blame the Democrats for Illinois if you want to. But New Jersey's financial problems, you should lay on the broad shoulders of Chris Christie. He ran the place for 8 years, cut things everywhere he could. And the new guy, Phil Murphy, is swimming and just trying to keep his head above water. So the other major message coming out of the Trump administration is China, China, China. It's all China's fault. Yesterday, I reported to you that Xi Jinping, the leader of China, addressed the World Health Organization conference, pledged four times as much money as Trump has cut from funding for the WHO. And Xi actually tried to deflect action on any kind of investigation into the origins of the coronavirus. So on Monday night, Trump issued a letter to the WHO riddled with threats and false and misleading statements. For example, he said that the WHO consistently ignored credible reports of the virus spreading in Wuhan in early December of 2019. And he specifically referenced reports in the British-based Lancet Medical Journal. But today, Lancet said, well, wait a minute. We published no report in December 2019 referring to a virus or outbreak in Wuhan or anywhere else in China. They said their first reports were published on January 24th, 4 days before WHO declared an international emergency. And this misrepresents the level of authority and investigative powers of the WHO. They are as strong as their member nations allow them to be in terms of sharing information and just being generally forthcoming in a timely basis. So Trump is clearly trying to rewrite very recent history because at the end of January, he was tweeting compliments at China. The U.S. greatly appreciates their efforts and transparency. It'll all work out well. In particular, on behalf of the American people, I want to thank President Xi. So let's compare that tweet, January 24th, 2020, with this comment made at a cabinet meeting today, May 19th, 2020. The Trump gang has assembled in a large meeting room at the White House. They are distanced, sitting at least 6 feet apart. I don't see a single one of them wearing masks. And as Trump enters the room, his dedicated fans cheer their man, and he immediately opens by blaming China.
So welcome to our cabinet meeting, and every member of my cabinet is working tirelessly to defeat the invisible enemy that should have never happened to our country, should have never happened to the world. It's a disgrace. It would have been stopped at the source if they decided not to do that. But we're going to safely reopen our country and our economy, and it's happening very rapidly. And it's happening, interestingly, when numbers are actually going down. You look at Florida, the state of Florida, great job. You look at Georgia, you look at others, they're open, and some are doing extremely well, far beyond what people thought. And the numbers are going down. The numbers that we have been talking about for the last 2 months are actually going down, so it's really terrific. In our drive to crush the virus, the U.S. has completed nearly 12 million tests, and that number today is almost 14 million.
He is so compulsive. When he mentions a number, he's got to jack it up. He's done this for years now, no matter what the number is. He offers what appears to be an accurate number, and then he inflates it. He just can't help himself.
Nobody's close. Germany would be second with approximately 10 million less than us, and we also have the best test.
We have the best test. And, of course, the total number is meaningless. It has to be measured per capita. And so you get the idea, and I'm sure you'll see other sound bites coming out of this dramatic sales pitch coming from Trump. Here is today's COVID-19 update, edited by Linda Lewis. We have a total death count worldwide of 319,000 attributed to COVID-related symptoms. And in the United States, the number has escalated over 90,000. We're at officially 90,432. And after she filed her initial report, Linda sent me an update and the video from the White House. Thank you, Linda. This is from USA Today. The scientist who created Florida's COVID-19 data portal wasn't just removed from her position on May 5th. She was fired on Monday by the Department of Health for refusing to manipulate data. So the two states that Trump mentioned, Florida and Georgia, are using data that has likely been manipulated. I confessed late in the podcast yesterday that I actually relied on a report relayed by Rush Limbaugh last Friday that, surprisingly, the numbers for Georgia, the first state to quote-unquote reopen, were surprisingly low. Well, those data had been badly doctored, and it was soon discovered. So Rebecca Jones said that she single-handedly created two applications in two languages, four dashboards, six unique maps with layers of data functionality for 32 variables covering 500,000 lines of data. Her objective was to create a way for Floridians and researchers to see what the COVID-19 situation was in real time. And then she was dismissed. And she says she was fired because she was ordered to make changes. She said, "They're making a lot of changes. I would advise being diligent in your respective uses of this data." Well, that is a clear warning in very polite language. She said on April 25th, "We're gearing up to provide more analytics and data. We have been directed to start tracking data related to reopening, and it is consuming a lot of staff hours on very short notice." Days later, she would be removed from the position entirely, and her data users sounded the alarm that the government might be censoring science. So just like his embrace of hydroxychloroquine, you can't believe what Trump says. They've also made the decision to end the deployment of 40,000 National Guard members who had been deployed in states to help in coronavirus relief. And it's not clear if this is intentional, but it's hard not to presume that it is. An official with FEMA reported in an interagency call covered by Politico that the Guardsmen will face a hard stop on June 24th to prevent them from reaching the 90 days of duty credit needed to qualify for early retirement and educational benefits. On June 24th, most of these deployed Guardsmen will have 89 days of duty credit. Oh, pretty sick. Silver lining from the pandemic. Global emissions plunged by an unprecedented 17% since, this has been covered in March and April. And that's according to the journal Nature Climate Change. And in some nations, the drop was even steeper. Now, this is a clear sign that human activity is what leads to these emissions, which are, carbon heavy. And that, scientists have pointed it out, but you don't have to be a scientist to understand that that is a part of what is warming the planet. Also, during the shutdown, many U.S. cities experienced a sharp drop in crime. Estimates for March 16th to April 12th, which is when the shutdown and the shelter-in-place orders were at their peak. In 30 jurisdictions, 18 recorded decreases in violent crime. A 33% drop here in San Francisco, 25% drop in New York, and a 25% decline in Los Angeles. Washington and Baltimore both recorded an 8% decrease in violent crime. And the cities that saw some sort of increase, 12 of them, include Houston, Austin, and Nashville. Aggravated assaults increased in Washington, Denver, Houston, and in Volusia County, Florida. Not sure why Florida. Maybe that was a spring break phenomenon. Well, today over at Who, What, Why, we've posted a fresh interview that I recorded yesterday with their election integrity reporter, Gabriella Novello. And she is a bright young reporter who's been on the election integrity beat this year. We had a pretty wide-ranging discussion, primarily centered on the expansion of voting by mail. We also talked about the fiction of widespread voter fraud, the reality of voter suppression and election fraud by insiders. And one of the issues that we covered was the effort by appointees of Governor Cuomo in New York to snuff out the Democratic presidential primary to protect people from exposure to the virus, while nonsensically continuing voting in place in the precincts for all of the other elections, congressional, I don't think they have a Senate primary, and, state and local offices. So today, the appeals court upheld the lower court judge's ruling that said that the effort to scrap the presidential primary alone violated the constitutional rights of candidates Andrew Yang and Bernie Sanders. So we hope this will hold, but we saw in Wisconsin a dizzying sequence of events where the governor ordered a delay in the he was planning to just block the use of polling places and then extend the deadline for people to vote by mail. And the Republican-dominated state Supreme Court and then the Republican majority on the U.S. Supreme Court intervened, or interfered, if you will, and forced that election to go forward. Michigan will join the states that will mail absentee ballot applications to all registered voters for the congressional primary elections in August and the general election in November. Now, it doesn't say, they ran their presidential primary, on March 10th. And 50% of 2.3 million people who voted, voted by mail. And then they had local elections almost 2 weeks ago now, May 5th. And 99% of the people who voted used absentee ballots. Turnout doubled. And it's that is the factor, the turnout, or the participation rate, that scares the hell out of Republicans. Because they work hard to keep likely Democrats from voting, and when everybody participates, it gives those Republicans weak knees and the willies. As you know, people who are part of this podcast community have generously contributed to our community fund, and we are offering $100 grants to listeners who have a need for a little extra cash at this point. I'd love to be writing checks for $1,000 or $10,000, but we don't have resources like that. But we want to acknowledge the need and help where we can. So today's award is our first international grant. The request came from Melinda Priskin, who lives in Simi Valley in Southern California. Her parents live in Budapest. And Melinda owns a condo. Its monthly rent provides supplemental income to her elderly parents, aged 81 and 79. And right now, the tenant in the condo can't make rent payments, so the parents don't get that extra income. So, Melinda, thank you for putting forward your request. I will be putting a $100 check in the mail to you today. And however you get money to your parents in Budapest, I hope it will provide just a little relief for them to go shop for groceries, pay some bills that might be piling up, or maybe just have some sort of a good time. And I have news from Hungary today. The hardline leader, Viktor Orban, who got the legislative body there, the parliament, to give him the power to rule by decree, well, he is poised to approve, actually, the way it works. The president will sign off on legislation that passed that will end legal recognition for transsexual people. And the bill that has been passed is described by activists as pushing the country back toward the Dark Ages. The new law defines gender as based on chromosomes at birth, meaning previous provisions where trans people could alter their gender and name on official documents will no longer be available. And the report here from The Guardian indicates that people have to show their identity cards frequently in Hungary, and that means that trans people will not be able to choose a name that fits with their identified gender, as the law requires first names to be chosen from a list kept by the country's Academy of Sciences, which is sorted according to gender. And one trans activist said, it basically means coming out as trans to complete strangers all the time. And this is a hideous step backward. I know many people are uncomfortable with even the concept of transgenders. But I believe that these are fundamental human rights that are being bulldozed. And Trump has appealed to the same backward sentiments among people here in the United States. A victory for justice in Israel, and a rare one. A district court Monday convicted a Jewish extremist of murder in a 2015 arson attack that killed a Palestinian toddler and his parents. The court ruled that the Jewish settler, Amram Ben Yulil, hurled firebombs late at night into a West Bank home in July of 2015 as the family slept. Now, while it was widely condemned at the time, we know that Israel often finds ways to exonerate Israelis who commit gruesome crimes. And we will wait and see how this holds up on appeal and what the sentence actually turns out to be. It took me a while to read through it because it's a lengthy, detailed, and well-documented report. But I want to compliment Max Blumenthal and the Gray Zone Project for a really strong expose. It relates to the Spanish security company that was hired by the American billionaire gambling operator, Sheldon Adelson. The Spanish company is UC Global, run by David Morales. He got a contract to do security for the Las Vegas Sands. That is the business empire of Sheldon Adelson. And at the same time, the company run by Morales, UC Global, had a separate contract with the state of Ecuador. And the contract was to provide security at the embassy in London, where Julian Assange had been given asylum. So, playing both sides of the street, UC Global upped its security tools, its spyware, in the suite, I think it's just two rooms, where Assange was holed up. And they upgraded security cameras to sophisticated cameras with microphones. And then they set up a separate pipeline. One stream of the video and sound was fed to Ecuador, and the other was fed to UC Global. And then that separate stream was captured, and it appears it was shared with what is described repeatedly in the documents that the Gray Zone Project obtained as the Americans. And there are strong implications here that the Americans were the CIA, led at the time by Mike Pompeo, now playing Secretary of State. The contact at the Adelson operation, the Sands, was an Israeli-American named Zohar Lahav. He personally recruited Morales, then managed the relationship between the Spanish security contractor and Sands on a regular basis. They became friends. Morales would brag to his partners and co-workers that he had hit the big leagues, that's my line, and that he was, getting this big contract. So the details are very strong. There are emails that Max Blumenthal has come into possession of that detail the operation. Morales' wife posted pictures on Instagram of time that she spent in Las Vegas that overlaps with times that her husband was meeting with the representatives of the Sands operation. And also, Blumenthal reports that there was a history because the top security guy named Brian Nagel at the Las Vegas Sands used to work for the Secret Service. And he was a specialist. He'd received the CIA's Intelligence Community Seal Medallion, an award given to non-CIA personnel who made significant contributions to the agency's intelligence efforts. They even have a picture of the camera-shy Brian Nagel. This is quite a powerful exposé. And they link it to Mike Pompeo's time at CIA and a speech that he gave early on where he demonized WikiLeaks, went to great lengths to negatively describe Julian Assange. And so I've linked to the story. I recommend that you read it and absorb it because it shows that our government clearly was the unseen hand behind violations of the embassy sovereignty of the nation of Ecuador that led to the extraction of Julian Assange and now the extradition hearings that he faces, which have been deferred until September. And yes, there's a conspiracy theory here that Sheldon Adelson conspired with a Spanish security firm, UC Global, to deliver actionable and, in cases, live intelligence to the Americans, most likely the Central Intelligence Agency. And when Pamela Anderson and her boobs visited Assange, they captured her email, her mobile phone passwords were stolen, So it was a very thorough operation, and there are PowerPoints that Morales picked up that were probably written by the CIA, not just the goons at the Adelson organization. So this is a very damaging report, and so far, have you seen it anywhere else in the U.S. media? I haven't. Kudos to Max Blumenthal. Also, at the Gray Zone, our old friend Gareth Porter is pulling back the the cover on a false story that was promoted after the U.S. had the had arranged the assassination of General Soleimani, Qasem Soleimani, the top military operative from Iran. And the fake story was that there was an alliance back in 2003 between al-Qaeda and General Soleimani and the Quds Force in Iran. And Gareth Porter does an excellent job of proving that the reports that surfaced, including in the Wall Street Journal and on National Public Radio, the claim that Soleimani deliberately unleashed al-Qaeda terrorist Abu al-Zarqawi's campaign to kill Shiites in Iraq, was based on a book called The Exile, written by two British journalists, who Porter argues definitely should have known that the story is false, because there was a group of people related to Osama bin Laden's huge family who were allowed into Iran and temporarily given shelter but under tight security in March of 2003. It was right before the U.S. ill-fated invasion of Iraq. And so this is the kind of fake news that Trump loves, because it advances false links between Iran and al-Qaeda. It feeds more Americans to support the idea of a war against Iran. And I thank Gareth Porter for that report. Also want to recommend at Consortium News today a post by John Kiriakou, the CIA whistleblower, and a colleague also described as a whistleblower from the CIA, Pedro Israel Orta. And I don't know Orta's story, but they argue that when Trump fired the Intelligence Community Inspector General Michael Atkinson last month, that it was justified. Now, not for the exact same reasons that Trump would argue. First, the writers here, Kiriakou and Orta, argue that Atkinson was quick to defend the Ukraine whistleblower who launched the whole expose of the phone call, the perfect phone call, with Zelensky and Trump. And as you know, I don't doubt the Ukraine scenario. I've always been uncomfortable with the whistleblower as its origin. But over time, Adam Schiff and the Intelligence Committee in the House, I think, did develop a strong case with testimony from Trump administration officials and diplomats that Trump did threaten Zelensky in a way that was improper and probably illegal. It was the basis for the flawed impeachment effort by the House Democrats. So Kiriakou and Orta go on to argue that Atkinson has failed to enforce whistleblower reprisal protections for those inside the intelligence community who have reported wrongdoing. They say that Trump correctly fired Atkinson for serious integrity, efficiency, and effectiveness issues in failing to protect intelligence community whistleblowers and covering up whistleblower reprisals. Now, they name cases, but I don't know the details of them. One is a guy named John Reedy, another James Pars. He went through authorized channels with serious allegations of wrongdoing, and they retaliated against him. And the third case is Daniel Meyer, former executive director of whistleblowing for the Office of the Intelligence Community Inspector General. So it's an interesting argument. I, as I say, don't have enough information on the underlying cases that they base their argument on. Now, Trump's handpicked, deeply loyal partisan nominee to run the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, that's separate from the IG, is John Ratcliffe, currently serving as a congressman from Texas. And today, the Republicans on the Intelligence Committee, now temporarily chaired by Marco Rubio, they voted 8-7 to move that nomination to the floor, where the McConnell Republicans have the votes to secure his confirmation. So get ready for a wild ride in the intelligence community. We have more ugly video surfacing showing bad treatment of African Americans. The latest comes from, I don't know how they say it in Missouri, it looks like Des Paris. And this occurred on March 23rd at a Sam's Club in that town. A 68-year-old African American woman has now filed a lawsuit against four cops and their St. Louis suburban department after they were captured in a video beating, arresting her and her adult son. Now, they were accused of stealing a television. Their story is that 43-year-old Derek Gray had purchased a big-screen TV at Sam's Club, and he was, he bought the TV but couldn't fit it into his SUV. When he came back to retrieve it, employees falsely accused him of stealing it. He managed to verify his purchase and take the TV home. But then the mother was outraged by it and said, "Take it back. We're not doing business with Sam's Club." So they took it back to the store, and that's when they were tackled and arrested without cause in the presence of several witnesses. Mrs. Gray thought her son was about to be another black man unjustifiably shot and killed by the police, said an attorney for the family. You can see in the video that she's terrified with respect to what they're doing to her son. And more evidence has surfaced regarding the late Ahmaud Arbery. He's the African-American jogger who was shot and killed after two white men chased him on the 23rd of February. And we now know that back in November of 2017, there's a photo here that appears to come from a body camera of an officer. And Arbery was stopped for questioning by the cops when he sat alone in his car in a local park. And they escalated. An officer attempted to use a taser when Arbery became agitated and began to ask the officers why they were hassling him if he wasn't committing a crime. Now, the cops claim that they think he was smoking weed, and he refused to let them search his car. And they eventually allowed him to leave on foot because his license was suspended. So they say they attempted to use a taser on him. I don't know how serious that impact was. Tasers can be quite nasty and fatal in some cases. And finally today, also from Georgia and also related to an African American, Stacey Abrams is openly running for vice president. And she gets praise in a column today in the New York Times under the byline of Mark Leibovich. He says that in the past, people who wanted to be VP had to act like they were reluctant, but that Stacey Abrams is not reluctant. So I honor her ambition. I think she's a very interesting woman. I supported her quest for Georgia, for the governorship in Georgia, and believe that she was cheated out of that by the current occupant of the office, Brian Kemp, who was then the Secretary of State and presided over obvious voter suppression, including the refusal to register voters who had completed the forms, but they were basically just put in a drawer at the Secretary of State's office. So I believe that she was cheated out of that election. And I think that she is an interesting and dynamic leader. I have to say I'm not excited about her being Joe Biden's, Biden's vice president candidate. Number one, she is inexperienced. She served in the Georgia legislature and I believe was the equivalent of speaker in the lower house. But that's not national experience. And I think that this is an unfortunate foray into identity politics. And when we separate her, Stacey Abrams, from the kind of mechanics of the election, number one, can she carry Georgia? She was cheated out of it before. Can we believe that a legitimate election with Stacey Abrams as VP would lead to putting Georgia in the Democratic column? That's an open question. Then we have to ask, with Joe Biden at 78 years old, do we want someone with limited experience, limited to the state level, to be second in line for President of the United States? And will these issues be exploited by Republican operatives, starting with Trump, in a way that would make her a drag on the ticket instead of a plus? And I have to say that for a white guy like me to make critical comments of an African-American woman involves some risk, because people can misinterpret this and think that I'm racist or sexist or, you know, I'm picking on Stacey Abrams. But when I get cold and calculating about the best visible potential candidate for Joe Biden's running mate, I have to say it's Amy Klobuchar. Now, I think she's competent and qualified. She has substantial experience in Washington, 2 Senate terms under her belt. She got elected in Minnesota statewide in 2016 when Trump carried the state. While she is way too centrist and moderate for me, an incrementalist instead of a bold change actor, I think that she is a better fit for Biden. And should he resign or pass away if they got elected, I honestly feel that Amy Klobuchar has greater experience and depth than we would see in Stacey Abrams. So, chew on that a little bit. You got a comment? You can email Peter at peterbcollins.com. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You'll find it on YouTube. You're invited to share it all over the place. Oh, and the Roy Rogers Museum is no longer open in Victorville. Sorry.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.